Modern science was essentially begun by creationists, men who believed that a rational God had created a rational universe and that rational men could, through processes of observation, experimentation, and reason, learn much about the creation. Well, let's sample some of the evidence from genetics as it helps us develop a new biology based on creation rather than evolution. It may be helpful to arrange this evidence under four categories, that is, the four sources of variation: environment, recombination, mutation, and creation. Now, a combination of these four sources can explain any and all variation that we see in the living world. Now, first of all, environment. What do I mean by that? I mean all of the external factors that affect the creature during its lifetime. For example, one person may have darker skin than another simply because he gets more sunshine. Or may have bigger muscles because they exercise more. Or they may have a greater resistance to disease because they eat right. These would be included what we mean environmental changes or environmental variations. And of course, these can be very important for the individual that possesses them, but they have no importance at all for the history of life because environmentally caused variation dies with the individual. They are not inherited. In the middle 1800s, some of the scientists who are interested in the history of life and who rejected the Creator believed that these kinds of variations could be inherited. Charles Darwin accepted this fallacy, and it no doubt made it easier for him to believe that one kind of creature could change into another. He thus explained the origin of the giraffe's long neck through, quote, the inherited effects of the increased use of parts. He believed that during hard times, giraffes would stretch their necks to reach the leaves higher up on the trees, and then they would pass these stretched necks along to their offspring, which would then inherit them, and that's how we got the long-necked giraffe. Now, a person who is studying the living creation based on the creation model is not tempted to fall into that kind of a fallacy, because he realizes that in a perfect creation, there'd be no need for new variations, that all the necessary variation would already be present in the creation without the necessity for new ones. All right, the second source of variation, recombination. This refers to shuffling the genes. It happens when each one of us begins life. We begin life when a sperm fertilizes an egg. And this brings together a new combination of inheritance. It's why children will look something like either of both parents, but not exactly like either one, because we get half of our inheritance from mother and half of our inheritance from father. Now, the discovery of the principles of recombination was Mendel's great contribution to the science of genetics. Here in his garden in Austria, he studied seven different pairs of traits in the garden pea. And in each of these, he showed that while traits might be hidden for a generation, they never were lost. There it is. Okay. Yeah, I'll do it again. So the traits might disappear for a generation or more, but when they reappeared, it was not because there was a new variation. Anything new had been created or produced, but simply because the genes that had been hidden reasserted themselves and reappeared. Now, whoops, wrong button. Sorry. I know you're getting tired of reruns, folks, but all right. Good. Now, this same principle of the temporary disappearance of traits and then their reappearance, not observed just in peas, but also in corn, and not just in corn, but all other plants where these kinds of experiments are done, and also it's true in all the animals in which these kinds of experiments are done. Now, this is what we mean by recombination, a production of a new kind of a new variation of characteristics simply because of shuffling, a recombination of the genes that were already present. However, even though this is sometimes used as evidence for evolution, it really isn't, because evidence from this area shows the limited nature of this kind of variation. And let me give you a couple of examples of that. Here are a number of different varieties of chickens which have been bred from the wild jungle fowl. And as you can see, quite a lot of variation has been possible through recombination. But there is an important consideration for us to keep in mind about this, and that is that no new varieties of chickens are being bred from the red jungle fowl. Why is that? Because all of the variation present in that species has been shuffled out into these different varieties, and just no more change is possible. Limited change. Now, that's an example from animal breeding. How about an example from plant breeding? When it was first found that the sugar beet had a considerable amount of sugar in it, about 6% sugar, the plant breeders went to work. And sure enough, they were successful for quite a few generations at increasing the sugar content in the sugar beet. But the time came when no more increase was possible. They got it up to 17%, and that was it. That was all the sugar increase that was possible. Any other changes that happened were downhill. Why was that? Because all the genes that have anything to do with sugar production were all concentrated in a single variety, and no more increase was possible. Well, let's consider an example of recombination that was provided for us by Charles Darwin. During Darwin's voyage around the world, he stopped off at the Galapagos Island and saw many islands and saw many intriguing creatures. And one of the most interesting groups was a group of land birds called finches, seen pictured here. Now, you can notice that these finches, although they belong to the same basic group of birds, they do have a considerable number of differences among them, primarily noticeable in their body size and also the size and shape of the beak. And the birds with the different bill shapes and sizes, have adopted different lifestyles. That is, some of them eat seeds. They have a heavy bill and they're able to crack seeds. Some have sharp-pointed beaks that they catch insects. But each one, there's even one that, although it doesn't have all of the equipment of a woodpecker, it occupies that lifestyle by picking thorns off the cactus and sticking them down in the holes and digging the insects out. So there's even a finch that lives like a woodpecker, even though he isn't one. Now, Darwin made what I believe to be an essentially correct interpretation of how these finches got to be the way they are. He stated that a limited number of individuals, maybe one pregnant female to use the ultimate minimum, was blown to the islands, and because there were no other land birds there, very few, these birds were able to diversify, Darwin thought in terms of evolution, into the kinds that we see today. And I think basically that was correct. In other words, I do think that he's probably right that a few pioneers had within them the genetic variability such that through recombination they were able to produce what we see today. But one of the evolution's most serious problems is the problem of extrapolation, that is, going beyond the information. And this is a good example of that. Here we see limited change, a group of birds, a group of finches, showing a considerable amount of variation. And so the evolutionist thinks this is evolution in action and these are changing into some other kind of creature, but the evidence is not there that it's so. These animals are still birds. They're not changing into anything else. They're not even changing into any other kind of bird. They're still all finches. So, again, it's an example of how recombination can produce a limited change. Now let's go on to the third source of variation, mutation. Mutations are mistakes in the genetic copying process. In each living cell, the genetic material is DNA. And this DNA provides the genetic language that determines what kind of creatures these creatures are going to be. And so every time a cell reproduces, the DNA has to be copied. Now, the cell has very intricately designed mechanisms for making sure that that copying is done right. And through hundreds and hundreds of thousands of copies, no mistakes are made. And sometimes if a mistake is made, there is even repair machinery to correct the mistakes. But even saying that, we do live in a fallen creation. And some mistakes are not corrected, and some mistakes creep through. And these mistakes we call mutations. One out of every, say, 10 to 100,000 times a gene is copied will have some kind of mistake, some kind of mutation. Now, what kinds of changes are produced by mutation? Now, some of the changes will have no effect at all on the creature. The DNA language contains a certain amount of what we call redundancy. That is, where the message can be slightly changed and have zero effect. So some of the mutations will have no effect for that reason. Other mutations have very little or no effect because the change they produce has no harmful or beneficial or anything else effect on the creature. So many, many mutations are not even noticed. They produce so small a change in the end result they have no appreciable effect on the creature. But there are many mutations that have had significant effects on their owners. Now, based on the creation model, what kinds of effects would we expect from random mutations, from genetic mistakes? Well, starting from a perfect creation, we would expect that virtually all of them would be harmful. Starting from a perfect creation, you'd expect almost all changes would be downhill, would make the creature less successful than it was before. And this prediction is borne out most convincingly by the data. A few examples may help to illustrate this. One of the more interesting mutations is the mutation albinism. These creatures have lost the ability through a genetic mistake to produce body color, and so they are as you see them here. Now this also includes usually with it some harmful side effects such as impaired eyesight. Also in plants, albinism is a mutation that occurs. These are not original mutations, but this is a variety of corn that has the albino mutation in it. That's why there's so many of them seen here. In this case, the mutation is lethal because these plants will not be able to carry out photosynthesis, lacking chlorophyll, and they will die as soon as they use up all the food that was stored in the seed. So there we have a lethal mutation with albinism. Now, it probably would be a good idea not to dwell on bizarre mutations, but to think of it in a little more scholarly light, because as many of you know, the evolutionist bases practically, essentially the whole history of life on mutations, because the evolutionist believes that all variation is the result of mutations, as far as new kinds of creatures coming about. So we need to give need to not be flippant about this, but give careful consideration to what mutations can do. And probably the best source for this kind of information is the fruit fly. Geneticists have been breeding this little insect almost since the turn of the century, and we know lots and lots, probably more than any other animal, about the inheritance of this creature. I have on my own bookshelf a 470-page book that just deals with genetic variation in this little insect. Now, what do we find among the some 3,000 mutations that have been identified in the fruit fly? Well, let's look at a couple of examples here. Many mutations have been found which affect the wings, and here are just a few of them. Changes in shape and angle and size of the wings. But never has there been a mutation that increase the ability of the fly to fly. None have ever made the fruit fly a better flyer. Now, this is generally what we see throughout all of the mutations, that almost all of them are harmful or at best neutral in their effects. None of them have produced a more successful fruit fly, none of the 3,000, exactly as we would predict based on the creation model. Now, it's also true that when we look at mutations in other species, such as this corn plant mutation, or this corn ear mutation, that we do not find increased success but harm, and at best of little effect, but usually harmful or lethal in their effects. This extends to our own species. Here the case of what's called xeroderma pigmentosum, kind of a big word for a genetic disease, a mutation that has happened during our history, in which these individuals who possess this mutation are unable to repair the genetic damage of sunlight. And because of this inability to repair the damage of the ultraviolet radiation of sunlight, they are covered with cancers, eventually lethal skin cancers, so that they die usually in childhood. Now, it seems appropriate at this time to take a little side trip and talk a little bit about the control of mutations. Now, certainly if mutations such as this one were free to spread throughout our species and other creatures, soon life would become extinct on the earth. So there must be some mechanism provided by the Creator in order to prevent this from happening, even in a fallen creation. And indeed we do have such a mutation, such a mechanism. This mechanism is called natural selection. It is one of the roles of natural selection to prevent the spread of mutations through a species. We must not allow the fact that, as I've already mentioned, that circular reasoning is involved in natural selection to pretend that it doesn't exist. Some creationists have fallen into that trap. Natural selection is real, it does take place, and it's really nothing very fancy as that comes down, it comes to a definition, because natural selection simply refers to the fact that creatures that are more successful in life are going to tend to leave more offspring. And so their particular combination of genes are going to be more heavily represented in future generations than are less successful individuals. That's all there is to natural selection, nothing more or less. Now, the fact that it was Charles Darwin who called our attention to natural selection is probably more a comment on the sorry state of creation science during the 1800s than it is on anything a comment on the validity of the concept of natural selection. We should have thought of it first, but we didn't. Now, let me give you one example here that's everybody's favorite example of natural selection, and that's the peppered moth of England. And I apologize, many of you probably already heard this 13 times, but for the two or three of you that never heard of it, let me run through it real quick, so that now everybody has. The peppered moth in England comes in two color varieties seen here. There's a solid black variety, which is rather easy to see on this tree trunk, and then there's a speckled variety, which is not so easy to see. Now, the same principles that camouflage the speckled variety from us also camouflage the speckled variety from a hungry bird. Such that a bird flying by this tree would be much more likely to grab off the black moth than the speckled one. Now, back when they first started counting these moths and looked at the early insect collections, they found that something like 90% of the moths were speckled and only 10% were black. Now, these all belong to the same species. They're just varieties within the species, such as like races within our own species. But anyway, most of the moths were the speckled variety because they were the ones that were able to survive from the birds. Now, when the industrial age came to England, coal was one of the primary power sources that was used. And if you've ever lived where coal was used as a power source, at least before the Environmental Protection Agency started their business, you know that burning coal tends to put a layer of soot all over everything. Well, the tree trunks of England were no exception. The trunks were blackened, and the camouflage was reversed. Such that almost suddenly, you could say, it was the black moth that was camouflaged, and the speckled moth was the one that stood out like a sore thumb. Well, not too many years went by before most of the moths were black, and much fewer were speckled. That's natural selection. Not in this case operating to prevent mutations, but of taking the variation that's already present in the species and increasing the most favorable combinations to allow that creature to survive in whatever environment it finds itself. This is the positive role of natural selection. The negative role, eliminate mutations. The positive role takes the best variations that are already existing in the species and increases the best combination. Now, back to mutations just for a moment. Is there no such thing as a beneficial mutation? Well, I think I'm going to have to depart from some of my creationist colleagues that maintain the impossibility of a beneficial mutation. Now, a beneficial mutation is simply a mutation that makes it possible for its owner to produce more offspring for the next generation than a creature that doesn't have the mutation. That's all a biologist means when he says a mutation is beneficial. Doesn't mean it's morally better or anything like that, but simply it allows the creature to have more kids. That's just the bottom line of what a beneficial mutation is. Now, one type of mutation that creationists ought to agree is beneficial is what we call a back mutation. You know, mutations can occur in two directions. You can have a created variation, a created gene, mutate to a harmful mutation, but it can mutate back again. Well, if that isn't a beneficial mutation to get back to genetic perfection, I don't know what would be beneficial. Well, sure it is. We won't have any trouble with that. How about the possibility there might be a beneficial mutation from the created condition? Well, it's possible under some type of limited or special environmental circumstances. In 1914, a mutation was discovered in the cultivated tomato. The normal situation with a tomato was that it would have what's called indeterminate growth. That is, the limbs would grow to different lengths before they set flowers, and it would just be sort of a hodgepodge of where the fruit were. This mutation produced what's called determinate growth, where the branches all grew to about the same lengths and then produced flowers and then set fruit, and this made the harvesting of the tomatoes much easier. Now, this was a beneficial mutation to that variety because the plant breeders loved it and caused it to have lots and lots of offspring. In other words, they selected for that mutation. So there's one example of a beneficial mutation. Another limited type of beneficial mutation is seen in bacteria. whenever you, this is a picture here of a petri dish, a flat glass dish filled with this sort of orange bacteria food. And this white disc is a little piece of paper that's soaked in penicillin. And the penicillin is soaked out into the food so that the bacteria, where they can grow elsewhere on the plate, are not able to grow in this area. Well, let's see what we got over here. Let's see what I can draw up here on the screen. Okay, there's our petri dish with bacteria food in it. Now we put our little piece of paper up there with the penicillin in it, and we'll let the penicillin soak out into the food. And now let's grow some bacteria all over the place. Whoops, the bacteria can't grow where the penicillin is. Isn't that wonderful? Now, what you do find whenever you do this kind of a, essentially amounts to a demonstration, you do find sometimes in the clear area a colony of bacteria growing in the area that's soaked with penicillin or whatever antibiotic you're working with. And this is sometimes the result, not always, but sometimes the result of a mutation that has made these bacteria resistant to the antibiotic. Usually what it is, it's one cell, you see, that has the mutation, and then it grows up into the colony that we see. Now, this then is obviously a beneficial mutation to the bacteria that presents itself, and this is considered one of the major evidences for evolution. Again, it's a case of extrapolation because it's, what has happened is the evolution has blown this all out of proportion, and it really isn't evolution at all. What's happening here? A rather minor sort of change in a very specialized type of environment. But you see, bacteria don't usually grow where they're swamped with antibiotics. Usually they grow in places where there's none or almost none in their medium, particularly in the soil. Now, the other change that we notice with these kinds of antibiotic-resistant mutations is they almost always are harmful to the bacteria that possesses them if they're not growing swamped with antibiotic. In other words, if it's not a live or die situation, these bacteria actually grow slower than the normal types of bacteria. So in the normal situation, this is not a beneficial mutation, only in a very specialized type of arrangement. Now, another type of mutation that's a bit more significant involves the loss of a function or the loss of some structure. Charles Darwin called attention to wingless beetles on the island of Madeira. And certainly if a beetle lives on a windy island, it's a good idea not to do too much flying. You find yourself in the water. And so some of these beetles, you see, suffered a mutation that caused them to lose their wings. Well, this gave them an advantage over the dumb beetles that were still flying around and falling in the water because they couldn't fly, and so they couldn't get out in the water. And so this mutation has spread as a beneficial mutation in this rather limited or strange kind of environment. Another example would be sightless cave fish, fish that live in the dark in the caves whose eyes are atrophied. You know, you can see where the eyes were, but there's now just sort of a little clunk there and really nothing very functional. And what seems to have happened here is that these fish have, you know, after they took up residence in the cave, suffered mutations that caused them to lose their eyes. Now, out in the normal world with light and all that stuff, to lose your eyes is very bad indeed. But in a pitch black cave, eyes are good for nothing but to get injured by bumping into stuff. And so getting rid of the eyes in this case was good. It's a beneficial mutation for a cave fish. But now, is this kind of any kind of evolution? I mean, if we keep getting rid of structures like wings and eyes and arms and legs and stuff like that, what kind of evolution is that? Although the evolutionist uses these examples, they're not anything at all like what he needs. These all involve the loss of something that was already there. We don't see creatures growing legs that have never had legs or growing eyes that have never had eyes. This is what the evolutionist needs if he's going to support his case, and they just don't exist. Well, it's rather impossible to leave the subject of beneficial mutation without using another one of the evolutionist's favorite examples, and that's the case of sickle cell anemia. This is a human mutation. Oh, hello. This is a human mutation of the hemoglobin molecule. This huge protein that's in our red blood cells, its role is to transport oxygen from the air in our lungs to the cells of our body. And this During the history of our human species, a mutation has occurred in which just a tiny part of the molecule is wrong. It's not built right. And when a person gets this particular mutation from both parents, they have what's called sickle cell anemia. Their red blood cells, instead of having a nice normal disc shape, are sort of sickle shaped, sort of distorted in shape. And this leads to all kinds of problems. The cells don't live very long themselves, leading to a sort of anemia. And also, they tend to clog up the smaller blood vessels, which produces circulatory problems. So that individuals that suffer from this condition have painful joints and other disorders that often lead to an early death. Now, the uninitiated might well ask at this point, why are you talking about this now? You're supposed to be talking about beneficial mutations. Well, believe it or not, the evolutionist uses this as one of his favorite examples of beneficial mutations. Believe it or not. Why on earth is that? Certainly I haven't said anything beneficial about it so far. Well, interestingly enough, in countries where malaria is a disease, there can be a benefit involved. If a person receives a mutation for sickle cell anemia from one parent but not from the others, they don't have the disease. But what they do have is they have a resistance to malaria. That is when just getting one of the genes instead of two does not give them the disease, but it gives them a resistance to malaria, which is a disease of the blood. Now, so for someone who lives in a malaria-infested country, it's to their advantage personally to be carrying one of these mutations. Now, the question we might well ask, though, is this an example of evolution? Because the evolutionists think so. No, this is an example of a mutation that's going nowhere. Let's just think of an example of a perfect set of parents in a malaria-ridden country. That is, a man and a woman who have, each of them have one mutation for sickle cell anemia. So they don't have the disease, and they're resistant to malaria. What can they hope for among their children? Are their kids be resistant to the disease? I'm afraid not. Half of the kids are going to get both sickle cell genes from the parents and die of sickle cell anemia. A fourth of them. Another fourth of the kids, on the average, will get two normal genes from the parents, and they'll be susceptible to malaria. Only half of their kids are going to get their combination, that is, only one of the genes, and be resistant to malaria and not have a disease. So you see, this is what we call stabilizing selection. See, this is a mutation that's going nowhere, even in this situation. It's not going to increase. It's not going to decrease. I'll show you a little graphical illustration of that in a moment. Why evolutionists use sickle cell anemia as one of their favorite examples of beneficial mutations, the foundation of biological evolution, really eludes the imagination. Okay, well, let's try something here. Oh, I guess I forgot I had to push some buttons here. Put me in there, Ray. Put me in a 0.9, let's see, 0.9, enter, 0.9, enter, and 1. And I'll tell everybody what that means. Let's see if things get going. Another 0.9, and put the 1, but don't enter it. Now put the 1, and just let me talk a little bit about it. Now what we have here, this is a program that simulates natural selection. What would happen in a species, a population of creatures, during natural selection, during its history? And what we're going to see here is, first of all, a situation where most of the creatures have what we would call, say, the normal gene. We'll call it A1. But that some of the creatures have the abnormal gene. We'll call it A2, the mutation. Now, as many of you know from whatever biology you've had opportunity to study, speaking on very simple terms now, each one of us has two genes for each characteristic. One we got from mama and one we got from daddy. That's not too tough. So we've each got two of these genes. Now, we can each have two A1s or we can have two A2s. That is, we could have, in thinking in terms of sickle cell anemia, we could have two normal genes or two sickle cell genes, or we could have one of each, like we talked about the resistant person, an A1 and an A2. Now let's just see what happens when we simulate a situation where a species, where a mutation suddenly becomes an advantage. That is where using these numbers here, where the individual with two normal genes at the top is 90% successful, the individual with one normal gene is 90% successful, but the individual with two mutant genes is 100% successful. Now we started off where it was mostly success will be normal. So this population is going to start off where most of the creatures have two normal genes. That's going to be the red color on the screen. And then some of the individuals are going to have a normal gene and one mutant. Not very many, but that'll increase. And finally, just very, very few will have two mutant genes. That's the blue color. So we have kind of red, white, and blue. Red, two normal genes. White or yellow, depending on your perception here of what this is going to be one normal gene and one mutant gene, and then blue, two mutant genes. Hit the enter button there, and let's see if anything happens. Oh, good. Now, what this is doing, this computer is doing, it's solving an equation for generation after generation of natural selection. As you see, the mutant gene, not even showing up really yet, the two mutant types at the very bottom, but you see the two normal gene group is getting smaller and smaller. Now, the one normal and one mutant is increasing, and that's because of the benefit of having the mutant genes. Now, the mutant genes at the bottom are beginning to increase with time in their frequency in the population. As the individuals with two normal genes is coming down, the individuals with the white, the one normal, one mutant is coming up, and you see the mutant gene is really starting to take off now at the bottom. Here comes the normals down about the bottom out, and the one normal, one mutant has hit its peak, and it's starting to fall down now. And now the two mutant genes are taking over completely, and virtually the whole population now is just possessing the mutant gene. Now, this is what can happen, you see, over time, if a new genetic combination becomes valuable, has the advantage in natural selection. I don't even see those numbers, but that's essentially just the numbers that shows what the graph has already shown. Starting off, we had like 90% A1A1, two normal genes, 9-10% A1A2, and 0.3% A2A2. But by the time the thing was over with, almost all the genes were mutant. Now, one consideration that I've been looking into, but I just started looking into it, so I don't have some good data for you, is, yeah, that's true where it's going to get to, but has it got there yet? How much time, you know, creationists are really interested in time. How much time has there been? I don't have much time either. Well, we're doing all right. I want to tell you about the honeybee if I have time, because I don't think that's kind of something new I ran across the other day. That has something to do with time. You know, honeybees came to be around in more than 4,000 years. I'll get to that maybe a little tail end, but doesn't have anything to do with genetics. Anyway, how much time has there been? Particularly, say, now, for a creature like ourselves, it has a very long generation time and a very small litter size. You know, litter size has something to do with how fast these types of changes can get shuffled around too. So we have small litters and long generations. Well, how much time has it been around? I haven't been able to nail it down yet what the best figure is for generation time of humans, but this is just to give you the concept that I have a suspicion that we haven't gotten very far along in this thing. And we may have genetic changes going on, but we're still here at the beginning, and so of this graph. And so we may not be anything in like genetic equilibrium. And so many of what evolutionist geneticists are maintaining are true about our species and other species may not be true at all, because there simply hasn't been enough time for this thing to work itself out this way. Okay. Well, let's get on to the fourth source of variation, creation. Oh, yeah, well, I guess I do have a couple of things. Let me show you these just real quick. I forgot I took a few shots at some other programs. This is kind of interesting because I spent so much time on sickle cell anemia. I thought, well, how does sickle cell anemia work out on this little computer program? And so what it did was people who studied sickle cell anemia in Africa have arrived at these figures that if we consider an individual with the single gene for sickle cell anemia to be the 100%, just as a relative value, 100% fit because they don't get the disease and they're resistant to malaria. They say that a person with two normal genes is only 80% as fit because they're susceptible to malaria. And a person with two mutant genes is only 25% as fit because of the death rate of sickle cell anemia. Well, what would we see if we ran the program starting off, you see, with almost all of the population completely normal. You know, in other words, a few mutations for sickle cell anemia come into the human species there in Africa where malaria is such a problem. What do we see over time? Well, we see a change, and interestingly enough, it's a change that reaches an equilibrium figure very quickly, perhaps within the time span that humans have been on Earth. In other words, because the individuals with one normal and one mutant gene have the best fitness, they tend to stabilize out at about half of the, a little less than half of the population. The mutant gene individual, of course, the sickle cell anemia individuals never get to be very much of anything because they're all dying of sickle cell anemia. And we started off with almost everybody normal. This has dropped down to something above half, again, because of the depredation of malaria on this individual. Now, there's another chapter of the story, and that is when many of the inhabitants of Africa were captured and sold into slavery in the United States. Well, what does that have to do with genetics? Well, it has a very interesting thing because malaria is not a problem in the United States. And so all of a sudden we have this gene, this mutant gene, without any advantage. In other words, the advantage of being resistant to malaria is suddenly reduced. So ran the program again. Well, we took away the advantage or the disadvantage of having one sickle cell gene. In other words, having one sickle cell gene or none are equally 100% fit. And all we've got is the damage caused by sickle cell anemia. Well, that almost immediately the number of individuals in the population that have one mutant gene and one normal gene drops way down. Eventually, would disappear given enough time, and individuals with two normal genes takes off. And so this is just kind of an example of how once a mutation you see is removed from a harmful situation. Then it suddenly, with where it was beneficial, it loses its beneficial effect. Now, as creationists, we're always thinking anytime the evolution comes up with something, maybe so, but let me just think about that a while. So let's think about that a while. What is this an example of? Well, this gets a little biologically technical, and I'm not gonna, but most creationists who've thought about it consider any kind of disease, mutations, anything nasty and icky to be the result of the fall. In other words, the result of sin coming into the creation. All kinds of predators and parasites and all that kind of stuff is thought to be the result of the fall. Well, what is malaria if it isn't a disease? And so all we've had with this beneficial mutation is one part of the fall canceling out another. Again, fitting in very nicely with the creation model where we would expect nothing to improve on a perfect creation. All right. Why do we have to have a fourth source of variation, creation? The first three sources, environment, recombination, and mutation, the evolutionists have those three sources too in their model. But they don't have this fourth one, creation. Why do we? Well, just speaking scientifically, we have it because we know, we have concluded that the evidence shows that the first three methods are incompetent. They are insufficient to provide the kind of variation that we see on Earth today. They just cannot do the job. We see so much variation among living things within single species, and these types of variation, this amount of variation, could just not have been produced by the first three methods. There had to be created variation. God had to put within each created kind a certain amount of genetic variability that during the history of each kind has assorted itself out into some of the varieties and species that we see today. It's only thus that we can explain perhaps the origin of horses, donkeys, zebras, and other species from the same kind. The big cat, lions, tigers, leopards, the genetic evidence is that they all came from the same created kind. So evidently, within that original created kind was placed enough genetic variability such that they were able to sort themselves out into these varieties that we see today. The 118 or so varieties of the domestic dog, plus the foxes and jackals and wolves that all, again, genetically seem to belong to the same created kind. As each one of these creatures obeyed God's command to be fruitful, they sorted themselves out as they spread over the country into the various types we see today. Here's a picture of a donkey. This is one of the evidences you see that the zebra and the donkey come from the same created kind. Of course, we all know about mules, crosses between horses and donkeys. Yeah, I'll get it in a minute. Now, there's some problems with some of this. I want to tell you that not all biologists and not all creationist geneticists would agree with me that these come from the same created kind. But based on, I think it was Frank Marsh that came up with the concept, maybe somebody else, that if we see fertilization, sperm and egg join and go through some cell division, then we're going to say that these two creatures belong to the same created kind, and the reason they don't reproduce together more than they do is because of this recombination, this sorting out that's taken place during the history of each kind. There are some problems to be solved, but there's some interesting... For one thing, I just mentioned this kind of as a footnote for the more technically oriented, these ones that I would call members of the same horse kind have different numbers of chromosomes. But there's some very good evidence that animal species can undergo chromosome number changes without harmful effects. There's some other groups of creatures in the United States which seem to differ only in their chromosome numbers. Frankly, you just look at them all, they look the same, but the chromosome numbers are different. And so there seems to be some pretty good evidence that chromosome numbers can change within a created kind without killing the creatures. Not always, to be sure. Okay, well, let me tell you about... That's the end of my prepared part, the part I really wanted to get across to you. But I want to... He said I had 10 minutes, and far be it from me to waste a resource. I want to be a good steward, and that's biblical. And so let me just tell you give you a couple of little goodies. First of all, the honeybee. I was reading my science news not too many months ago, and said, you know, the honeybees, well, not yet. I'm going to have a couple more computer programs to throw at you. The honeybees have magnetic compasses in their heads that they use to help navigate to where food is. Now, many of us have heard about the dance and that sort of thing, but they also use the magnetic field of the earth to navigate with. They've got these magnetic particles that they use to migrate with. Well, that's interesting. But this one guy was doing research. He took them in the laboratory and subjected them to artificial magnetic field. In other words, he used an artificial magnet and jacked up the magnetic field. And he found that after the magnetic field got to a certain strength, the bees were completely disoriented. They could not navigate. How interesting, I said. I remember reading somewhere else something about magnetic fields and that they had something to do with creation. And so I went back to the pages and thought, well, now I got Tom Barnes' monograph out, you know, and looked and saw, you know, how strong was the magnetic field of the earth? How long ago? Well, it turns out if the magnetic field is stronger back in time, you go back to about 4,000 years, you hit this value at which honeybees are no longer able to navigate. So the honeybee testifies to the young age of the earth, believe it or not.